Clay, are you gonna be a MBSE user? Are you gonna be an architect of an MBSE system? Are you gonna be a consumer? Could be that you're all three. Depends on the role. And so, you know, what, how do you act in that way, in that role? So let's jump into it. First, we'll talk to, about some life questions. There was one question about Tom's discussion of sourcing and dual sourcing specifically, and that was the point that he was trying to make was that if you have a single source, that source potentially has leverage over you, and you may have to give up some of your margins so that they can make their margins. And so you would prefer to have products on a competitive market. If it is all possible, if there's competition, then they're going to bid away their margins and you can maintain yours. We talked about this a bit in SE5 when we talked about concepts, selection. So sourcing strategy could be a trade study. You could identify a number of potential candidates, explore the relative benefits that they bring to you, and then make a decision based on that. There's increasingly a challenge in some sectors of diminishing manufacturing sources. And especially in the defense environment, you have an office in the DOD that focuses just on industrial policy because of the concern that an important element of the system that you're developing is going to be out of business, and they're not going to be there anymore. What are you going to do in that case? But I was just reading this week about solar cells. So solar cells are pretty important. As we go forward, we want to build as many and deploy as many as we can. It turns out that at one point in the U.S. at least, we decided that it was a commodity business, and you know, it made more sense to design apps for smartphones or something. And so that business was offshore. Well, it turns out it's a pretty complicated system of processes. And particularly in China, an ecosystem for developing solar cells, including wafer fab and all these other things, developed. And now they have a huge cost advantage. And so in the last 2 years with the Inflation Reduction Act in the U.S., they said, well, let's build solar cells in the U.S. Well, it turns out we're at a significant cost disadvantage because we let go of that. So how do we build up the capability again? Well, you would probably do a trade study and evaluate, you know, where are the leverage points, which organizations do I want to invest in, how am I going to design the capability? And so it becomes kind of a design, an architecture and a system design problem. How do we regain capabilities? So that was the point I think that Tom was trying to make, is that sometimes you need to identify or even create a supplier for essential components in your system. Okay? All right. So you're familiar with this chart. This is from the NASA Systems Engineering Handbook. And milestones and work products. We have concept stakeholder identification, concept definitions, requirements, and on down through disposal, right? So there are a lot of work packages that you systems engineers are going to be producing during the course of this development. These are technical work packages. They could be related to a trade study. They could be related to analysis, simulation, documenting things like requirements, producing architectures, doing trade studies of architectures, you know, the whole works. And you're not going to be doing it just once. So you're probably going to be evolving this design in each of these technical work packages. So the question is, how do you keep track of all this stuff? And especially if this is a contract deliverable. Sometimes there's, in the DoD world, there's seed rules, contract deliverable. What does seed rule stand for?
Requirements list.
Requirements list, okay. So a list of things that you have to deliver as part of the technical data from the program. So this is just work, and this is part of, you know, why sometimes people think of systems engineering bureaucratic and time-consuming process, because you have to document things. So is there a way to make these activities more productive? And that's the whole idea behind model-based systems engineering. Okay, we produce a lot of documents, we do a lot of studies, we create technical data. How can we keep track of it? So the idea is that you would have common models, you'd have a common information source, you'd be able to reuse models and information and automate the documentation process. Right? So that's how you would make it more effective. And in some cases, you're driven to this because the systems are so complicated. So often when you talk, especially to a systems engineer, when you say MBSC, they're going to think, you're talking about SysML, system modeling language. And it's probably one of the most dominant modeling languages, not the only one. That's going to be a common association. The other common association is that there's going to be some kind of connection between all these models. And if you, as a systems engineer, create a system model, then it's automatically going to be valuable to the disciplines, engineering disciplines down the road. Okay? Because there's this, what they call a digital thread, connecting all the models together. So MBSC has been around for a long time. People have kind of coalesced around this idea, including SysML and digital thread. But organizations are still struggling with implementation of model-based systems engineering. So we're going to talk a little bit about why that is the case and maybe what you could do about it. All right? So let's talk about the basics. Systems engineering is designed to bring a bunch of potentially ad hoc inputs, you know, so you had that experience with OS3, here's a bunch of interview notes. How do we make sense of those? And other objectives and so forth. So you have this process where you document them formally, so you may have turn those into need statements. You might have some kind of way to evaluate different alternative architectures, create architectures and concepts, and as you go through the process, manage the change. And outcomes, on the other side, some design that you have a lot of confidence in, and some work packages like quality checks and B&B and so forth. So what systems engineering brings is a methodology to actually do these things. So you get these ad hoc inputs and you have a process. And so we've talked about during the lectures, during these processes. And we have a formal language in systems engineering of, you can think of the V, you can think of the PDP, but there's structured gates and terms that we use to help guide you through that process. And the idea behind MBSC is that you have then a modeling tool that supports the methods and the formal language, and it automates some of the steps for you, so that makes it a little bit easier, okay? So it turns out that not all the processes are ad hoc. It's certainly the user side they are, but we have the SDM program, we have SE handbooks, we have MCOSI, we have a number of ways to say, okay, here's what systems engineering is. So we have clearly defined methods. And then in terms of the formal languages, there are things like OPM, which you learned. And there's SysML and UML, Unified Modeling Language. So there are ways of describing systems in a formal fashion. And then the tools. So we have here a number of tool vendors. Some of you might be familiar with these. Magic Draw is Cameo Systems Modeler is one of the big tools that people use. It's SysML based. Allows you to draw diagrams of systems and perform work packages. Many of you will be familiar with MATLAB and Simulink. MathWorks went in a different direction from most of the general systems engineering community. Systems engineering community went with let's create a unified modeling language, system modeling language. MathWorks said, well, we have a lot of tools that already exist. Let's move into the system space from the basis of these tools that we have. So they have a different approach. And pretty good. And then you have organizations like PTC or DSO Systems or others that have these kind of all-in-one modeling languages where they bring in, not languages, but environments where they bring in a number of different tools. Or, for instance, like a Phoenix integration kind of sells itself as we're the integration tool that lets you connect all your other models and tools into one way of managing this data. Okay? So Capella is another one. It's kind of a cousin to Cameo out of France. And it's a little bit different from System Validates. Some people say it's easier to use for creating system models, just different approach. Okay, so there are a lot of opportunities out there. I've shared examples of Emslate, which is again built on a different modeling language, this lifecycle modeling language. So SysML started in 2001 at Encozy, and they said, well, we need to have a modeling language for systems. And so let's take UML, which existed for software already, and let's adapt it so that it works for what we do. And so they reused 7 of the 14 diagrams from UML, and they added a couple more, and now we're in SysML V2, and they've added some more diagrams, and so they're evolving it. And I'm going to show you some SysML diagrams, and there were a bunch in the assigned reading. So you should understand this. If you understand OPM, it's not much of a stretch for you to go to SysML. It's just some different syntax. Right? But if you capture the system and its properties in one of these modeling languages, the act of capturing that information records it in the database and identifies connections that exist between the elements and properties. And in the process of documenting something, you're creating the model structure. So here are the primary diagrams, and these should be pretty familiar because that's what we've been talking about. Structures, connections between elements in the system, requirements, behaviors. So you have, and these map to the classic systems engineering diagrams, like an activity diagram. You saw a sequence diagram when we talked about operational analysis. State machines, use cases. And then for the structure, you have a block diagram, system block diagram. This is just a lower level internal block diagram. Package for bringing all of these products together. So you need to have some organizing structure. And of course, parametrics. So this is an example of a car. And this is a requirement diagram, all right? So in something like SysML, you capture requirements, and there's nothing magic about it. It turns out you're just recording them in a structured fashion. So you could use Excel if you wanted. To just capture the language of the requirements. It doesn't do anything more, except that you can start connecting these requirements together. And when you can connect the requirements together, then you have better traceability. All right, so, but otherwise they are, you have the requirements identification and some text that's associated with the requirements, and it's an organizing construct. Yeah, a little bit better than Excel in this form, in this diagram. But when it's part of the larger modeling environment, then you can connect those requirements to, say, verification and validation activities, or functional architectures, or things like that. Any questions so far? Okay. So in this case, this is a behavior diagram. And you could have a sequence diagram. I've shown you that already in a prior lecture. This is a state diagram, and these are actually pretty helpful because you can identify the operating states. If you do the operational analysis and you look at sequences, then you can start looking at specific states that the system should operate in, and modes and transitions and triggers, and then all of a sudden you can model some pretty sophisticated system behavior. And this is even before you have, formal architecture or detailed design. So being able to model these kinds of behaviors is pretty important. So for instance, here we have ignition on, start the vehicle, ignition off, turn off the vehicle. You have the gear selector, the transmission. So if you have a certain mode selected, say neutral, then it controls how the system will behave or operate. So you can, this is all information that you can collect and use in your analysis. So, structural diagram, block definition diagram, you could call it system block diagram. So you have the vehicle, car, and it has a chassis, which includes, maybe has a fuel tank attached to the chassis. You have a body, interior powertrain, decomposition. So you can go into a lot of detail on some kind of diagram like this. Now, why is this helpful? Because you're making connections. Each of these potentially is an interface that you might want to track. And so you have that information recorded when you construct the diagram. And most of these tools are, use a modern graphic user interface. So it's just kind of drag and drop. It's pretty easy to build one of these diagrams. But as you're building a diagram, you're recording data. And sometimes in a pretty easy to do fashion. So you can construct one of these diagrams pretty quickly. And then you start putting in things like parameters or simple models, which you became familiar with, I guess, in OS 4, and you have all of a sudden making of a functional model that can tell you how the system is going to perform. So here's an example from the reading. You couldn't really read it in the book, but each of these has an equation in it and some values, and when you run this model together, it produces characterization of the powertrain of a car. You can do stuff like, let's see how quickly we can get up to 60 miles an hour. For instance, does it meet our requirement? Or, if you are connected with a machine model, then you can say, okay, what is my performance in third gear or fourth gear? So you can accomplish quite a bit using these pretty simple models. And this is kind of what SysML does for you. Let's see, another one. So we recorded the requirements earlier, and in most of the system modeling software, you will have a link to test cases, V&V test campaigns, test cases, test points, and you can then connect those directly to the requirements. And when you click through, you can even automate this and connect LabVIEW or some other sensor system, and when you've gone through a specific test point, it records the outcome, puts it in the model, and then you can trace that back to the requirements. Say, okay, here's a report of what we did and how we validated our requirements. So, automating work, that's not bad, especially when you have a lot of test points or requirements or other things to keep track of. So that's the vision behind MDSE, doing all the stuff that we've been talking about, plus more because we're becoming warm in spring, but doing all that stuff in a way that saves you time and energy and maybe cuts down on the number of full-time equivalent people that you need to have to do systems engineering. So pretty good. Yes, Mohammed.
Has there been any AI integration in that?
That's a good question. AI integration in MDSE, of course, everyone is interested in doing that. So one of our guest lecturers in the spring talks about how they're using AI to clean enormous trade spaces. So when you get into something like 10 to 100, 10 to 1,000 different combinations, because of all the variables you have, the first thing you want to do is trim that down as quickly as possible to get rid of the feasible solutions. So they're using AI in that. The work that we've been doing here is using neural nets and natural language processing to understand requirements. And there are a number of people that are interested in how we can use applied language models to help with requirements work. So it's creeping in, but if you think about it, the big progress that we've been making in AI has really been in the last 5 or so years. And so people are still kind of experimenting. Yes, Avi?
Professor, if organization has an BS tool and RMS tool board, what tools should be considered as a source of truth for requirements?
Well, so this is anticipating the discussion we're going to have a little bit later, but it turns out there are a lot of tools, not just one, and then the question becomes how do you integrate those tools together? So depending on the industry you're in, you might be using DORS, maybe JIRA, some other requirements tools. And it may be that you have another tool like Phoenix Integration that claims to bring everything together, or you have 3D Experience from Dassault, and we manage requirements, they say, in an integrated fashion. And maybe you don't have that, and you have to write a script or develop your own tool. But we're gonna touch on that a little bit more. Okay. So yes.
Is there a limit to the complexity of the problem where MBSE can be applied? I'm just wondering, like, you know, can we use MBSE to solve like really complex problems, like for example, designing a refinery where you're designing so many different components and everything else, right? So
yeah.
Looks like, I mean, so far we've looked at a simple demonstration, so I was curious, are there limitations to MBSE application?
In principle, no. So these will fit on the page and slide, so that's why they're simple. The idea behind MBSE is it scales. And in fact, for problems that you really can't keep track of with Excel and PowerPoint and with regular meetings of your team, you need some kind of infrastructure. And MBSE theoretically scales up. But if it's going to exceed the limitations of MBSE, it's going to more quickly exceed your mental capabilities of managing the problem. Sean, online question?
I just have a comment on the on the AI integration portion. I was at a conference last month, and Innoslay was actually presenting, and they were planning on bringing requirements integration capability. So I guess AI integrated test case analysis or test case generation based on the different requirements that might be in Innoslay. So it's something that they're developing, but like you said, it's still early in the conceptual stages. Just
want
to comment there.
Yeah, so that's a great comment, because if you go to conferences, you're going to hear vendors talk about all the great features they've got and that they're bringing online. Not to say anything about Innoslay, we had a relationship with them and they're great people. But looking at, you know, for instance, their requirements analysis tool, for us, you know, we discovered pretty quickly that it was not very sophisticated. It was great for catching common grammar violations, you know, the kind of 7 rules of good writing, good requirements writing. But in terms of AI, even the companies that have been doing this for many years are still puzzling over how AI brings some benefit or value to their tool. Okay? Other questions here in the classroom? Yeah.
Do you have thoughts on how people use different tools together, like Cameo versus Rhapsody, the DORS and things like that?
Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. But the question is not so much, you know, which tool do you use, but how do you integrate all the tools you have to use? And, you know, I'll get to the punchline, this is a system architect problem. And so put on your system architect hat if you get stuck in this position and start using those tools. And we'll talk about a bit more about that. Okay, Bernardo, question?
Professor Crowley, I may be hearing this wrong, but I don't come from a systems engineer background, so a bit of what you're sharing is like is new to me. And something that I am kind of like hearing or understanding here is we are presenting this MBSC kind of like a practice standard, or basically like the way I'm hearing it is like, hey, here is how we are agreeing, like all of the systems engineer across industries, that this is a good approach or like a good standard to be sticking to. And that is not what I experienced in my industry. I came from agriculture, and basically, of course, you know, you're art and science, right? And you, as a professional, you understand like the best management practices. But I can really relate like of this is where we all of the agronomists agree that is how we should be doing our big products or projects. And I'm curious on what do you think are enablers for this like broader agreement across industries, across subject matter expertises, if you will, that are like landing in this like kind of like cohesive tool or basically I just found fascinating that me from my company, I can listen what you're sharing and say, hey, this makes sense. And someone else in the oil industry or in the Navy are listening to the same and say, yes, we will just like take this tool and kind of apply because it does make sense. Like, what do you think are enablers for that to be coming together?
Yeah, so that's the question that people have been asking for the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. What are the enablers to getting everyone to do this? And I don't want to represent that this is standard. This is probably a consensus in organizations that are strongly affiliated with ENCOSI. And a few other industries are joining in. Auto industry, I'm more familiar with in the US than in say, Europe or Asia, are picking up the model-based systems engineering baton, so to speak. But there is not a consensus on what this actually looks like. And a big part of this, as we will see probably in the latter half of the lecture, comes down to what do the discipline engineers have to say about it. You know, the real engineers that are designing the product. And that's going to have a big bearing on what the solution looks like that you end up with in your specific context. But this is the potential that you could get from systems in model-based systems engineering. This is the vision. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about, up to this point, where are the PDP of all of these processes been? So I'll go back through these slides. Requirements, activities, block diagrams, parametrics, performance analysis at an architecture level. Where in the PDP process is this stuff taking place? Yeah, a lot of it's in the conceptual phase, concept development. And so early on, and then we get down here and we start linking this back to from B&B to requirements. So we have traceability. So we're jumping over to the other side of the systems engineering B. But a lot of this is taking place early on, and then the question arises, where does MBSE go after you've gotten out of the conceptual design phase? So let's look at why you might want to get into MBSE. So there are a lot of different strategic goals. And getting your organization to identify what are the strategic goals other than everyone else is doing that is important. Okay? Are you doing to reduce cycle time? Are you trying to get your designers to work together more closely? Is this going to enable you to spin out new designs and pursue new business opportunities? Reuse knowledge that you've created over time? Are you going to increase your quality? You know, a lot of different reasons you might want to embrace this kind of modeling technology. And we have some examples here. And I'll show you in more detail these, but usually it's about, we want to reduce cycle time. We want to reduce program costs. Or we're having a hard time managing complexity, and there are a lot of emergent behaviors in our systems, and so we need to have some way of understanding how these parts connect together. Okay. So, take a note. What is your reason for wanting to do MDSC? Okay? So it's part of your model-based enterprise. So you have model-based engineering, you might have model-based systems engineering embedded within that construct. But you might have a number of different things, including things like digital thread is a common motivation for organizations. They want everything to connect together, or a digital twin. Let's create new products and services by using our models. So here's some different examples from the Department of Defense in the US, from the Naval Air Systems Command in the US, from Airbus and Lockheed Martin. And of course, I haven't got any updated slides from other sectors, so I'll have aerospace and defense today. All right, so the US Department of Defense is big. But if you're involved in the military, what does the DOD actually do? A few opinions are ready to emerge here.
Spend money.
Spend money. Yeah, so basically they write policy, create rules that you have to follow, and they're a speed bump in the budgeting process. Right? And occasionally you have a special initiative that they do. But it's really about framing the environment. All right. So if you are the Department of Defense, you want to frame the environment or shape the environment, what do? Well, you have policy tools. You're going to write a bunch of policies around how we're going to use models. We're going to maintain the acquisition lifecycle, and we're going to update the acquisition lifecycle and the policies so that it includes model-based engineering. We're going to maybe fund some initiatives to develop capabilities, invest in specific maybe pathfinders or pilot projects to demonstrate how you can do that sort of thing. And they're going to invest in the workforce. Let's create a workforce that has this digital identity. Right? So, you know, they're not actually producing a product, but they're shaping the environment. And that's how they approach model-based systems engineering. It's, you know, here's a framework for thinking about it and how you work within this environment. Okay. Now, if you are Naval Air Systems Command, this is down at Pax River in, where is Pax River?
Maryland.
If you're down in Maryland and you're actually developing aircraft and other aircraft-related systems, then you're, well, they don't actually do it either. They're just looking over the contractor's shoulder. But you are really much closer to the work. And the contractors are going to be producing technical data packages, and you need to be able to ascertain whether they're making progress, do some analysis perhaps. Maybe you're going to update requirements. You want to have some connectivity with what is actually going on. And in fact, at Navera, they really embraced MDSC as a way for accelerating their SE transformation. So they started up at mission analysis. They said, we're going to start doing mission analysis using models. And then they proceed to the next phase, and we're going to do some capabilities development and system specs and models. And this was while working with their contractors, so you know they're bringing the supply base along with them. But this is a way for them to not only get into the digital era, but also to improve their systems engineering practice. Anybody here from NAVAIR? So I can speak freely. So, you know, at some point they're going to get into mechanical design models and electrical models and software and so forth, and analysis tools, and eventually into supply chain management. But this is kind of the vehicle that they are going to use for their digital transformation. At Airbus, okay, so this is at least the vision from 2019, was that you know, Airbus makes airplanes, but they also produce a lot of data and they use models, and so why not turn those models into a digital twin, and it's potentially a new source of revenue. In addition to selling airplanes and spare parts, you can sell services for maintenance. So you have digital continuity across the life cycle, as designed, as manufactured, and as maintained. By aircraft tail number, you can keep track of all of these things. And then go to your customer, maybe an airline, and say, hey, for this airplane, maybe you should fly this route, or you should update this subsystem, and you'll get better performance. And yeah, conceivably, somebody would pay you for that. That's a new source of revenue. Siddharth, comment, question?
On the previous slide, you were talking about the model-based engineering translating down to mechanical design, electrical design, and software design. Mm-hmm. Is the intent that, you know, from the requirements, we'll directly be able to export, like, you know, written or, you know, auto-generated code, or is it just to manage the requirements of what that code should be doing as it interacts with all the different subsystems and APIs?
So that's a great question. So what would they be doing? If they're thinking about systems engineering, why would they be worried about mechanical design models? Well, NAVAIR, even though they don't actually build airplanes, they do have a bunch of engineers. And not only systems engineers, but mechanical, electrical engineers, and so forth. And they're keeping track to make sure that, as an informed customer, they're getting good analysis, they're in a good position to make informed decisions about the path forward for an acquisition program. And so the question is, what is the connection between these mechanical design models and a system model? Well, requirements is a good answer, because that's how we communicate with one another as engineers typically. But there may be some other things. So for instance, we might be interested in the interaction between mechanical elements of the system and other mechanical elements or electrical elements or other things like that. So we have interfaces to control. There's a change management process that we want to control. So all of those, that system environment helps you with all of those processes. Yes, Mohammed?
Yes, so is digital twin a replacement for
No. And in fact, we'll have a lecture in the spring on digital twins. So we'll just take a deep dive. It's not a short answer. It's a way to use the tools to create a new value stream. Okay, so the idea is if you have these engineering tools that are good enough that you could predict the behavior of a system, then maybe they're good enough to predict behavior of systems that are in actual use, right? But it's both a fad, so a lot of people are jumping on the digital twin bandwagon, but it's also, there's some substance there, and the question is, how can you use this to generate new revenue streams for your business? And so this is a vision with that Airbus expressed it, but they're not alone. A lot of companies have said, let's use a digital twin concept as part of our engineering designs. And again, we'll go and take a deep dive into that in this room. Long question?
Yeah, so this is more of a comment for Peter. So, like, we were talking about the Airbus jumper here, and pretty much on the Boeing side also. Not, if you think earlier days, when in all the industries, we had been using a model and a drawing, like a printable drawing. And in most of these aerospace companies, we have done away with that. We do not use anymore any printing model or 2D drawings. What we use is a called MBD, a model-based definition, wherein everything in the digital world, we have all the drawing specs defined, and 3D rotating, zoom, everything you can do. And if that can be used for 3D printing or assembling, and we have just got away from that drawing concept at all. And that also helps us integrate everything into one common environment or the database throughout the life cycle, we call it PDM and PLM. But right from the concept phase all to the end of life cycle, we are just using the same environment to look into, make the change board decisions and evolve the designs. So you have all the manufacturing nodes, you have all the tolerances, you have all the dimensions, everything all controlled in one location without having that discoherent, you know, having drawings obsolete and then you've got evolved models.
That's a great example. Thank you for sharing that. Here's kind of the Airbus version of that. But the idea is, as you go through the elaboration of these models, as you go through the life cycle, you're adding information at each step. And the database that you have allows you to capture that information. So you can have a 3D model. In some cases, people are saying, but still kind of working around figuring out how to do it, but saying that we should have model-based requirements. Let's have a model that reflects the requirement of the system or element that we want to create, and we'll give that to our vendor or to our partner or to a group within an organization. So there's a trend towards using models as much as possible, but yes, as you accumulate, as each of the elements of the system accumulates information, you can record that in database, often referred to as a data lake, where all the bits, you know, float around and stay until you need them. And you can have a fully defined system at some point that says, okay, here's an exact model of our vehicle or our medical device or whatever, and we can send it off to manufacturing and have that produce it. We can ship that to suppliers or build a print, construction, whatever. Kayla, you have a question? Comment?
Yeah, I'm confused about so like all of these ones that you're showing right now are simulation based on different functional things of engineering. But I wouldn't consider them MBSE because they're, describe like what is MBSE and what is just another digital tool?
Well, so the systems engineers have claimed as MBSE as a system level model representation. And so they're using typically system modeling languages to represent the system. And so you have, and this is happening typically when system engineers are most active in a program, so it's going to be happening in the early stages of the product lifecycle up through concept. But yeah, there are lots of engineers who use models. And the models tend to get more sophisticated over time, more detailed, their power of prediction increases. So drawing a line between model-based systems engineering and model-based engineering is a hard task. It's fuzzy. And it comes down to what does your organization want to, how do you want to define the boundaries around what is model-based systems engineering, what isn't.
Okay. But you're kind of saying if it's coded maybe in like SysML maybe in Simulink, then you would kind of say that's MBSE and maybe the others aren't.
You know, I don't really have a position on that. For me, it's model-based engineering, and there's some engineering tasks that involve systems, there's some engineering tasks that involve more detailed design, and there's engineering tasks that involve software and other elements. And in the end, you would like to have the use of models increase the performance of your system. And so it gets back to why are you doing this? Why do you want model-based systems engineering, model-based engineering? Usually productivity, cycle time, whatever. But in order to accomplish that, you need to look at your organization and how you develop products and systems. Say, okay, well, where could we use some help from the digital tools? Okay. Do you have a
Yep. Just I'm not sure, I'm pretty confused. Like this MPSC, it seems like in certain applications it can be a tool or methodology like in design phase. But in certain applications like digital twin or predictive maintenance or prognostic maintenance software, it seems like a product itself. Not sure whether can you clarify, is that what I'm understanding? Like it can be used, person applying, can be used in both as a tool and a product.
So I agree with you. In some cases, this is going to be a tool. In some cases, this is going to be a product that you deliver. And I'm sorry for being vague about that, but again, I think that the point here is that we should talk about the capabilities that we want and how those capabilities can help us, and not get hung up on how we characterize or name those capabilities. Nicole, you're from Airbus. You're probably familiar with DDMS.
Yes, I'm very familiar with DDMS. It's a big activity in Greece, especially implemented a lot of early analysis. There are some examples, maybe not yet published, but even through the DDMS, we are doing some staging of the rockets for the latest Ariana. We, for example, implement the entire cycles from manufacturing in our structure together with virtual testing, modeling, and so on. There were some good examples, still a bit of hesitation, but progress, I would say.
Yeah, so one of the active research projects I'm involved in is with Airbus and with the DDMS folks. And so we get a little bit of insight into what they're doing, but every organization is struggling with understanding how to implement these tools and how to really get the payoff that they're looking for from the implementation of the MBSC. This is another example from Lockheed Martin. I think that the thing I would just point out here is these lines represent some connectivity between the tools across the life cycle. And so that's one of the visions you'll often hear about from MBSC advocates, is that we can connect across the life cycle. Easy to say, hard to do, because there are different organizations that are managing different parts of the life cycle. And if you're in some environments, a different funding streams are defining who is working on what area and how much they collaborate with people outside of their own area. So let's talk about JPL and their implementation of MBSC. But first, let's take a 5-minute break.
Thank you.
code or something like that. but you are in more of an oversight function. So you're hiring a vendor, a contractor, or somebody to deliver a system for you. And you need to be an informed customer. What does MBSE do for you? And I think there are a lot of you who are in that position in the room, and so I would love to hear from you and your experience how MBSE has helped you or been disappointing to you. James, Jameson. Muted.
Hello. So I was on the T7 program, and I was in that position, right? So we were the government, the Air Force, buying from Boeing. And while we didn't ask for enough in the contract to do what I'm about to say, it was easy to see a world where you could monitor the design and build of a system from a customer perspective in a way that you never could before. I mean, you could get hourly reports of any issues in your system, anything that was designed outside of a tolerance or didn't meet a requirement, and you could just get those reports from the system that they were using to build the design whenever you wanted. And so there's a lot of insight that could come from that. So I would encourage customers to ask for the whole kit and caboodle from an MBSE perspective.
Okay, yeah, because the system is just, it's caching all that information, and many of these applications are able to generate reports automatically. So if you have access to that, a question for you on T7, so how do you stay on top of all that information? You get this fire hose of information. What do you, as someone who's got an oversight responsibility, how do you handle all that information now that's potentially coming to you?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't like saying the term AI or machine learning, so I just to refer to it as robots, because I don't really understand it. But I think in the future, we will use the robots to cull the information and give it to a subject matter expert to say, okay, person, you are right person to review this set of information. And I think that will happen in the future. I think we've always had too much data, right? Like we had too much data 30 years ago for people to actually review. So they just would sample, right? And so I think at this point, we're just sampling in a digital space as opposed to sampling with documents in a hard copy space. And I see in 10 years, the robots will do the sampling and then provide us with a summary document to review. From a subject matter expert perspective.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, until those robots come around, you're going to have to be a good enough engineer that you can sample the data and make sense of it. And so when you have, and this is whether it's across an organizational boundary or, you know, the person who's working for you generating data with a model, it's still the same problem we've had for quite some time now. How do you have enough sophistication to understand what that data is telling you.
So I got a good example about the site. We were building an offshore platform in Angola, right? And the contractor had given us, we get a full 3D model of the entire platform that we're building. And at this point, we were in startup phase of the project. And then we got a question about a certain vessel that was in one of the areas of the platform. So this is like, it's all very constrained, right? Like everything has to fit where it has to fit. Long story short, what we did with this model is that we measured every single pipe that was going from one end to the other, every curve, every turn, every elbow, and then we created a hydraulic calculation of the cooling and the heat medium. and we found out there was an overpressure scenario just from using just the model. Like it was like last minute, right? So it was a huge deal because it meant that if we would have built it, if we were started up the way that we had it, it would have potentially blown up the system because it was overpressured. So we made a last minute decision of trimming the impellers of the cooling medium system just based off on the information that we got from the model. So long story short, we got this, like created a spreadsheet, pretty much a huge spreadsheet, entered all like manual calculations, identified our first scenario, and then contracted a contractor to hold the show, hired a contractor to do everything. And they proved that was true, right? So that was really
interesting. So in this case, it was a contractor's design that they submitted to you and then you ended up doing additional analysis.
Sure. Yeah, that's right.
So again, illustrating that if you're going to have an oversight function, good news is you have all this information available to you. So you can do that kind of analysis. But the caveat is that you still have to do engineering work and be sophisticated enough to be able to interpret or ask questions like, are we going to have an overpressure problem with this design? Okay. Ishii?
Thank you, Professor. So I also work for the government, so I have an oversight function at work. So what MVSC does for me is it provides a way of standardize all the documentation from the contractor. Because I noticed a lot of contractors, they deliver drawing to us. For example, they use the Visio drawings, but every Visio drawing is different. So each ICD is like they use different standard, different color scheme and all that stuff. The problem with the heading is, so when we want to extract stuff, we have to like do it manually. So basically either myself or one of my engineers will do a document and extract it. So what my team came up with was to standardize that using SysML, so we can easily run a simple query to extract those data. So that's what MVSC is doing for me.
Yeah, great example. So forcing standardization of information. If you have a data construct, then the data has to fit in that construct. And it turns out that can be really helpful for doing additional analysis. Okay, great discussion. Thank you for your contributions. So here's an example that goes a little bit beyond just the conversation about SysML. This is what NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory was doing at least a couple of years ago. And so they have, this is their computer-aided engineering systems pipeline. I don't know, they could call it model-based systems engineering, but it's pretty much the same thing. So the life cycle they cover is everything from capturing issues, deconflicting them, uncovering the new ones, going through the design process, modeling specs, analysis, simulations, and so forth, and then producing the products we've been talking about, the documents, all right? So here are some of the modeling languages that they're using. So graphical modeling languages, which we would lump SysML into. It's not a superpower, analytic language. So you have different versions of graphical modeling languages where you can draw box diagrams like I showed you. Modelica and MATLAB are great for system modeling. A lot of power in both of them. MATLAB has got a lot of different applications. And for code and so forth, you have Jupyter and Python and so forth. And then different ways of managing the information. Okay? So a number of different things that they're using to do the job. A number of different applications. So this is their software modeling tool stack. So for design, they have Doors and Magic Draw and Oxygen. And then they have, for development, those of you in math and in software development will recognize these more than me. But they use tools that software people use to develop their software. And it's not just one tool. It's a lot of different tools. And if you go to different teams, they're probably going to have a favorite tool that's different from the next team's favorite tool. right? That becomes a problem at some point. And then you have qualification and operation, right? So lots of things moving around in a real organization. This is their architecture, and this is one of the common themes in model-based systems engineering is you have the authoritative source of truth or information. Some people will call it a data lake, but this is where you're storing all the information from Jupyter and from Maple MVE and from Java and all of these other things. You're storing it in, excuse me, in a common data construct that allows you to query and access and retrieve and update this information. So that if you're over here and someone is making a change over there, then that is reflected in the data lake. So people aren't working to different versions and causing problems from that. It turns out, despite all the vendors that are offering solutions, that JPL created their own infrastructure for modeling, and they call it OpenMVE. Don't ask me what that stands for. But it's a way for integrating the outputs from these tools so that they connect with the inputs from other tools. In order to get through the product development process from start to finish, they have to create some way of integrating the tool stack. And so they created their own open environment. But PTVC won't say that they can do that. Other vendors will say that they can do that. And what the decision was for JPL, I'm not sure. Maybe it just made sense for them to develop their own environment, but if companies are compatible, organizations are big enough, they can afford to do that, then they will. Yeah, Chris?
What is the key difference between the data lake and a cloud infrastructure, or is it the same idea?
So I think it's the same idea. The cloud infrastructure might be a specific instantiation. The data lake could reside on, you know, hard drive somewhere. But I think increasingly we're going to toward cloud-based data and applications. So it's just, you know, a matter of, you know, what technology are we working with? Okay. Other questions? So this is starting to reveal, you know, if you're in an actual organization and working on hard problems, all of a sudden there are going to be a lot of different things that have to work together in order for you to have a model-based environment, right? And this is a version that some of you, John Deere, have seen, and those of you at Boeing have seen this. This diamond is the alternative to the systems engineering V, where this is essentially the systems engineering V. Here on the bottom, this is in the physical space. And on the top, you have the equivalent, where you have a model that it corresponds to the system definition, and you have subsystem models corresponding to subsystem definitions and so forth. And at the end, you know, you might have a digital twin or just a digital model, depending on a number of factors. But the idea is that eventually we'll go to a full digital representation of and instantiation of all the activities that you perform in the physical space. And these relate to different parts of the life cycle. So you have the need stage, and this is where you have the customer acquisition group, the people who are working in that area, bringing customers in. You have product development, which we're all very familiar with. Product realization, which is typically the, you know, factory physical products or coding happens in hardware and software. And then you have customer support downstream. And sales, service, updates, all sorts of things, potentially linked into this digital diamond. So let me tell you about a study that we did 2 years ago, I guess. So this is a big company that wanted to go digital, adopt model-based systems engineering and digital threat. And so we did a study of, you know, how do you do that? Because you've been around for a long time. You've got thousands of engineers and thousands of tools that you use. You just snap your finger and all of a sudden you're digital. So we used, we looked at a number of their documents, looked at their applications, interfaces, technical system, organizational structure, who's reporting to who. Used a multi-domain matrix, which I covered very briefly in a previous discussion. Understand interaction between tools and processes and organizations. And the idea was, can we gain some insights to understand how to re-architect the system? So so here you have your data and tool networks. Okay, so you, maybe it's a data lake, maybe it's a bunch of data ponds and tools. And you have clusters of tools that are used to perform process A. So let's say we're going to design make up a good fictitious example here. We're gonna design let's say it's an airplane. So let's design the wing for an airplane. And we have maybe multiple organizations involved in designing that wing. Maybe we have the OEM, maybe we have a supplier or the and then there are lots of different tools that are going to be used in the analysis, structural tools, dynamics like resonance and flutter, electrical, and so forth. And they draw on data, and then the data comes and goes from this data lake. And then maybe this wing design gets passed on and gets integrated into the fuselage. And these are requiring different tool clusters. And so there's a lot of interaction between these different groups and these different tool clusters. And so we fortunately had access to the tools. This is the MDM. So we have processes, organizations, tools, and data flows. And how does work course through this organization? So we had the tools, there were about 8,000 active engineering tools. So we were able to do, we didn't use DSM, we used network diagrams. And so the tool DSM, so the question is, if I'm looking at tools, how does that relate to the processes? And so we could map the interactions between tools and processes. Because there are formally defined processes in the product development process, and tools that are supposed to accomplish those. And we can go through and we can derive a number of these relationships just by mapping all these different things. Now, this isn't easy. Turns out most organizations don't collect this kind of information. So you have to make some assumptions and sometimes deal with missing information and so forth. And then you go back to the organization with the results and they say, well, you know, let's not put too much emphasis on that because we really don't manage that tool, that database. So, so don't adjust your glasses. This is intentionally blurry. But this is essentially a high-level map of the way tools are connected in this organization. All right, so what we see is that there are clusters of tools that interact with each other and they're connected. And you can imagine why that might be the case, but the marketing tools are connected. You know, all the people that have to do work with marketing, they make connections with all the tools. The engineers of different companies, the manufacturing people, okay? And so you have these little cluster communities of people who can communicate with one another, and occasionally you have connections between these nodes. And sometimes the nodes aren't even identified, so one of the outcomes of doing that multi-domain analysis by looking at the interaction between tools and processes and organizations was that we were able to induce or infer some of these clusters that weren't officially recognized. And so we could identify these links between these. So we identified a number of these different hubs using the analysis, but I think the takeaway here is look at your own organization, the one that you're most familiar with. You have this kind of a structure of activities and tools connected together. Because this is what you're gonna, this is gonna be, you know, one of the roadblocks between you and that unified vision of model-based engineering, where everything is connected together. Yeah, Dennis.
I think, yeah, I guess the simple version of my question is, are we modeling the product or the process? And the V, or the diamond, I guess, made me think, you know, okay, yeah, that's a model of the product in a way, right? Like, and then here, it feels a little bit like we're modeling the process with which we build the product. And maybe it's both or either, but...
That's a great question. This is a subtle shift. Taking off your Ironman MVSE user hat and putting on the MVSE architect hat. Okay, so if I'm going to design a system, I need to understand what the currency is. And this is an example of why it's hard and why it's been so challenging for many organizations to adopt model-based systems engineering, specifically model-based engineering in general. As you have, especially if it's been around for a while, if it isn't a clean start organization where you can build things the way you want them to be, you're going to have a legacy. And that legacy is not only in the tools that you're using, but in the organizational relationships that exist. And so you're going to be looking probably in a large, complex organization at a number of connected communities. And those are the people that you have to convince that there's a better way. Thank you. So you can engineer connections between tools, and actually this is, I think, reflected in the next slide. Okay? So you can engineer connections between tools. If you're an engineer or you're in an oversight position and you want information and you're not getting it and you're frustrated, you can put some effort into bridging that gap. And so as we did the network analysis, we were looking for what we call orphan tools, ones that don't have any obvious connections to other tools, but are important to the process. And what we found, or if we were looking at two tools that should have been connected because they were adjacent in the product development process. So, you know, one would naturally lead to the other, but there's no real connection between those tools. And so you have these workarounds. And so, yeah, people do create, engineers create workarounds so they can get their job done. And the workarounds are often not documented, and sometimes they're really efficient. Sometimes they'll say, well, hey, there's this new cloud-based solution that is way better than whatever the people in IT are telling us to use. And so you see a lot of departure from what the assumption is of how the system works. And these paths that go around out of the normal process are one indicator, orphan tools are another indicator. And it's not a bad thing because people are getting work done, but it may make it challenging for you as the architect of an MVSE system to rationalize the flows through the system. Yes?
Yeah, in our company, we also make an effort try to balance the global versus country. We also need to consider the different country policies, like some European country or Asia country have some laws that restrict the data to be explored outside of the country board. So we need to consider that.
Yeah, there are
regulations.
A lot of reasons why it's hard to have an integrated system.
Right.
it's an uphill battle. And then, you know, vendors are coming out with a new tool to do better every 2 or 3 years. And do you upgrade, do you switch? It's challenging. So, you know, our observation was that we could be strategic about the interconnection between at least the hubs and start there. Say, okay, these hubs that are connected to one another, maybe there's a single solution, or maybe there are, you know, multiple but deliberate solutions that connect these hubs together. And that's the start of your digital thread to the network. And maybe you just abandon the hope, you know, if you have thousands of engineers and thousands of applications, if you're ever going to have a monolithic structure, but at least you have a data construct that enables them to work together. I think I covered that. Federated for centralized. Okay. So one of the things that came out of this pretty quickly for me, especially as I was doing interviews with the senior engineers, was that there are really kind of two worlds in play in this organization. And one of them is the systems engineers who are saying, man, we need to have a system solution. And then you talk to the engineers who are designing product, and I'll say specifically, they're designing product that goes into production. So these are designing to a bill of materials. It has to work. Has to not kill people in the real world. It has to not drive the company into bankruptcy. And their tools and their models have to be very good in order to predict the behavior in the real world. Okay? And they take a lot of pride in that. But we have great tools. We can model really hard problems, and we can save money by, you know, using simulations rather than prototypes. So they're very proud of their models, and they have to have good models in order to deliver to the factory. The engineers, systems engineers, are coming up with great concepts, and they know where the connections are, where the potential problems are in the system, you know, between subsystems, interactions, that sort of emergent behavior. And what I call an adverse adoption gradient, as you get further along in the PDP process, you have a demand for more fidelity and accuracy in your models. And the people who own those models are not going to accept a very rough model, you know, willingly, unless they see the value in that. And so it's not going to be natural for you to say, let's start here and say, okay, we're going to build system models and you guys are all going to benefit. You got to convince them. And so that's one of the challenges that you'll face in designing a socio-technical system. I don't know if any of you have had that experience of trying to convince people that your model is going to help them, even though it's not as detailed as their model. See a lot of heads nodding. So let's talk about why we would trust a model. So if it's my model, of course I trust it, because I made it, and it's a great model. It's the best we can do. But if it's someone else's model, and they want me to make commitments based on that model, then I'm going to be a little bit more interested in understanding what they did when they built it. So this is part of some research that we did that was just concluded. I don't know if any of you watched that crash test video that I had. We didn't get a chance to cover it in the lecture. But I commented a little bit about this in automobiles. For many years, the way you tested whether a car was safe was you crashed it into a barrier and measured the loads on the crash test dummies. Right? And so this was focusing on what they call passive safety, that's structural safety, and no active measures are being made. It's, you know, that whatever is in the car, the structure protects the passenger. And so around the 90s, they started experimenting with the new and improving finite element analysis. And they were using it to validate crash tests. So you build a bunch of prototypes, crash into the wall, and eventually, these models got to be pretty good because they had years and years of data to work with. and they were improving them. The models themselves were improving, so you could have finer meshes, structures. The regulators were participating in this process and said, well, those models are pretty good. And so they kind of became confident. And eventually there was a turning point where the finite element analysis models were good enough, and everybody agreed that they were good enough, that you could use that for passing off a lot of the safety, you know, validating a lot of the safety requirements for cars. Right? But it took, you know, a couple of decades to do that with a lot of people participating. So when you think about it, who has to agree? Who has to buy in? Well, certainly the structures group, they're the ones that are interested, but then you have the finite element analysis analyst. And maybe the person has got a new technique or tool that hasn't been used previously in structures. You have other engineering disciplines. Central engineering has to, you know, pay for this capability and manufacturing. Program manager, of course, the executives are going to be concerned about whether you can put a product on the road with it's only been through simulation. Is there a liability of concern here? And then there, you know, National Highway Transportation Safety Administration and Highway Safety, something like that. People, the insurers who pay for damaged vehicles, they care a lot about whether they survive or not, and more importantly, damaged people. So there are a lot of outside stakeholders that have to be involved in this. And this is a nice example, because you can see how over a period of many years, all these stakeholders came together. They were able to look at the data, look at the models, and see that there was some benefit. And so, today's problem is very similar, I think, at least in terms of the state at which passive safety was in the 1990s. Nowadays, we're thinking about active safety. So what does that mean? Driver assistance, sensors, autonomy, security. So we have a bunch of sensors, and we have a bunch of computing power, and we have maybe connections off the vehicle to other information sources or sensors. And the question is, do we have enough confidence in these models that we would put them out in the market? Well, you have, I think, kind of the same problem that you have here. You have the same set of stakeholders. There's some public safety stakeholders, I think, that are more concerned now as well. Municipalities, highway administration, that sort of thing. So how are we going to solve this problem with active safety? Mohammed?
I just want to comment. I worked on this a little bit. It's vehicle to everything communication. And the issue is the technology exists and it's been there for a while now. But the problem is with the stakeholders not trusting this technology. So you see countries that maybe the transportation authority don't want to implement the infrastructure. So the technology's there, the cars have the technology, but there is no infrastructure. These sensors that are attached to traffic lights or along the road, they call it roadside units, they're not there because the regulator or the authority body don't want to implement these. So the technology existed for a while.
If you watch a video, or if you've actually been inside one of those Amazon fulfillment centers with all the robots zipping about, you know, that's a good example of autonomy. But it's in a well-defined environment. It's a closed environment, and they can put in the beacons and guide signals and so forth. So the robots can have a map of an environment, and there's not a lot of variability. You go out into the real world, into a neighborhood. You know, can you tell the difference between a bicyclist and a trash can? What happens when something moves into the field of view suddenly? Is it a ball? Is it a person? Is it an animal? We don't have the same predictability over and control over the natural environment that you would have, say, in a factory. So this is a hard problem, but in 20 years, maybe it's going to be solved. Right, but you got all these stakeholders. And they've got to agree that if you're going to be doing modeling, which is really kind of necessary for this kind of analysis, that the models are accurate enough that you have confidence in them. So that was the basis for that research. And I won't go into this. You can contact me afterwards if you're interested in the topic. Yeah, well.
I had a general question about modeling.
Yep.
In terms of product development. In these projects, how much of the total product development cost is spent on modeling versus actually testing and fielding, deploying the device?
Yeah, I think I would open that up to either Go or that question.
So there's no like golden ratio to follow. Is it just that when the team is confident enough, they're going to say, all right, let's move to the next step in this development process?
Well, usually in a stage gate process, you have to demonstrate that you've met some criteria in order to get past the gate, right? And there are different ways to verify that you've done that work, including modeling. But I'd be interested to hear from the students. What's your rule of thumb? Your own.
So making the model takes so much time. So if you say if you have one car, we can make the model for the car using a lot of time. But the next car, like they say, next car has a different stamping method. So which means the CO metal has a different stretch, like percentage, or 10% or 20%. So that makes the model different. So it makes a lot of time to reset model. So we have to keep the model continuously, even the one car is launched. So a lot of time or money. I don't have an idea of the exact number, but the huge
effort. Yeah. Well, Michael, online, do you have an estimate?
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
So work here, as you mentioned earlier, we use the D model or the diamond model a decent amount, and for the past couple of projects as we've tried to do more model based, it's been probably 20-30% of the staffing for our project has been on maintaining and building those models. So between software and mechanical and hydraulic and electric, 20-30% is just building the model.
Thank you. Yes.
So I think well, I'm trying to understand the question, but like, how long does it take to model, and then how long does it take to build the product? Probably depending on like how complex your product is. For like at Boeing, I guess just general numbers, it takes about 10 years to develop an airplane right now. And like you said, we have like 12 gates to get to before we actually build one. It's about, depending how big your plane is. Let's say like 30-60 days to like build one plane. Your first product was probably gonna have a factory, like a ramp-up factory, so it's gonna take a lot longer. But that ratio is kind of crazy. It's like, I don't know, nine years to develop the model, and then a couple months to build the product. I guess one of the reasons we're trying to do MBSC is like really shorten that development period of time, so your ratio of like time to build an airplane to developing would be a lot less.
Okay, good, thank you. John.
Obviously, I don't have a number, but in my opinion, like as complexity, we're only going to scale complexity continuously, and all we're trying to do is find the offshoots to help burden and absorb that complexity, and that's where I see MBSC. So I don't think the ratio really, I'm going to be a cynic and say, I don't think the developmental time will ever decrease, because complexity will always outpace our ability to decrease that timeline. I think you're only going to see it. It's just helping absorb that.
Yeah, no, that's a good answer. And I think that another way to state that is as the models evolve and improve, our expectations for performance will evolve with them. And so we won't see a decrease, usually, in product development cycle time or cost, but we'll see a huge improvement in product quality. So if you watched that video of the cars crashing together, you know, the product quality of cars has increased dramatically over years, not just in terms of passive safety, but performance, emissions is another area where modeling and simulation has really had a huge impact, but we don't really notice it. And that's, that requires regulators to buy into, you know, your emissions. So we've seen dramatic improvements in product quality, stubborn product development investment and cycle time. And I think it's because we just grow the requirements to, you know, accommodate the new capabilities. Kristen, you had a comment?
More so a question, just if you don't have the depth of historical data, how are you factoring in the safety, uncertainty, additional risks on predictive?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think our conclusion from this study is that there's no shortcut to getting people to buy in. You have to develop that history with the models and empirical validation. And actually, this gets to, you know, what we found were the elements of model confidence. So you have things that are inherent to the model itself. Okay, so the way you design the model, whether you use standards, whether it's industry accepted, whether you've used test data to calibrate the model and confirm that it works. There are some modeler-related constructs. Okay, so who built the model? Do we trust that person? They have experience building that model. Have they produced models in the past that have worked well? So it's kind of a reputation effect. And then there's some stakeholder-related constructs. So think of the stakeholder as a kind of the decision maker, the consumer of the model information. Okay. Are they inclined to trust someone else when they present model results? Have they been burned in the past by using a model that maybe was a little bit before its time to be accurate? There are a number of factors, and you can see that the things that we focus on mostly are model related. As engineers, we design models and we want to build the best model we can, but there are a number of social factors that come into play when you're asking someone to have confidence in the model that you've created, and then you produce some results and ask them to decide and make a commitment based on the results. Wallace, you had a comment?
So I think on about the models, as long as we are giving the right license to models, we see that they are also equally accepted by the regulators. When choosing a processor model to the actual test, it's also about timeline and seeing. We are not just looking at the system level when you have built the prototype. You want to take that from day one of the component level modeling. But if you start making just a nut or bolt, and that's when you start having gone through each and every piece through the steps in FEA and hyperMesh modeling, and having analyzed the at the component levels when the system is built, still again, and infers the same kind of load condition. And also, in most of industries, like in aerospace, what you get from the integrator is only a bunch of load cases, objects of data points, all the different loads. So the best environment and efficiency seems to have going through these hypermesh and the FTA models to test them, unless it's really a novel technology where you want to invest in creating an environment and the physical infrastructure with the both side of the regulatory agencies. And as I feel, it's very expensive, time consuming, and it's not the, you know, appropriate way to do the test. So those are problems. And then every tool we are talking about has inbuilt margin of safety and the safety factors into consideration. So as long as you can pass the model, you have the right assumptions in place, and if the margin of safety is showing on the positive side, you can be reliable that those systems are going to work well in the real fit scenario.
Oh, okay, thank you. So we had a really bad connection, so I got about every third word, but I thought I was good from what I heard. Okay, so kind of the life of the problem of a model building effort. Okay, you go through a number of steps to actually build a model. Now, I'm not going to go into those in detail because we don't have time, but if you reflect on models that you use, are you documenting this kind of process? Are you creating a model pedigree? If you're going to offer a model and a results of the model to a customer, do you have a pedigree to say, look, we went through this process to ensure that these predictions are pretty good predictions? Right, so this is another thing that you can do in terms of model validation, data validation, and so forth, to increase model confidence. And the idea was that we would create essentially a pedigree sheet that would be at the beginning of a presentation for maybe a gate review. You go to the decision makers and say, hey, we're going to give you some model results, and here's the pedigree of this model. Here are all the things that you should know about this model that you're going to see the results of, so that you can decide how much confidence you want to have in that model. Some helpful practices. We talked already about how multiple generations of models establish the history and, to some extent, the validity of the model. Often, having multidisciplinary teams and organizations working together on the development of a model will ease people's concerns about whether a model is valid. And, of course, just you have to have correlation between the test data and the model's results. So, there was a question earlier about how much we spend on this kind of modeling activity, right? And maybe another way to ask that question is, what is our investment in the models that we use, and how are we going to get a return on that investment? And this brings in the concept of a model lake. So you've heard of, we mentioned data lakes, because we have the common data repository. If you really want to leverage the power of models, you want to be able to reuse them. Something they'll have to evolve, as Hiro mentioned, and be updated, and that's part of the ongoing investment. And so there's a SDM seminar from this last year from Donna Rhodes talking about model curation. And it is kind of what you would expect from that term. You have a function in your organization where the models are maintained and curated and updated, and you have a record of them so that you can retrieve a model when you need it, and you have confidence that it's going to be functioning as expected. All right? And as you can reuse those models, then you start getting a return on your investment in the creation of the models. The more you reuse them, the better your return. So the question is, how do we select and propose models for this kind of purpose? Right. I'm gonna actually skip through this because we're out of time. But you know, there are processes, and I don't know if we can really say much about the idea, but. You have to have a process for bringing models into the library, and you have to have a curator, and there's probably a role of a model curator, and somebody who's going to update and maintain. And do you assign that to the engineers who develop the model? Or do you have a separate person? So there are a number of, again, socio-technical system challenges that raise their head when you start thinking about, we're going to go model-based, okay? Well, now you've got a model infrastructure you've got to maintain. Who's going to do it? Wrong direction. Now, I talked to, we talked about DDMS at Airbus. I talked to one of the leads in that. So their job is to roll model-based engineering out to the entire company. And we were talking about this lecture, and he confirmed my observations. So, but you know, he gave me this quote. When it comes to implementing model-based systems in engineering, and he got it from somebody who's even more senior than him. It says, first do systems engineering, then do model-based systems engineering. So all the things that we've been talking about so far in the class, do those, and if you go back to when we talked about requirements and you had DLR5 and we talked about Elon Musk's five-step design process, you remember that? First, make the requirements less dumb. So get rid of the stuff that you don't need to do. Delete a part, simplify the design, accelerate the cycle time, and then automate it. Okay? So going back to those strategic objectives for model-based systems engineering, what is it you want to do? What is it you're expecting model-based systems engineering to do for you? Figure that out in your complex socio-technical system. Figure out what the connections are that have to be established. And then it's probably a good time to automate the process. Okay. Meanwhile, some of these tools can help you. But think about it in terms of the architect of the system. Now, this is content on transforming complex systems, and we'll cover it in the spring. So you're not going to miss anything here, but I want to get to the transition at the end. This is our last time together for a little while. I'll be back, I think, with some of the early complaints. So the deliverables of the system architect, system concept and plan, that's what you heard from Ed and Bruce. For me, hopefully, you heard that the deliverable for the systems engineer is a system technical solution. Right? How do you define the technical system? And then for what you're going to hear from Brian Moser is the program manager delivers value to the system stakeholders, the value of the program. As you go into this next module with Brian, some things to think about. So we talked about all the data products that we've created. Those are going to be inputs into your project design. So what is your role as a systems engineer? What data do you need to bring forward as you think about designing a project? And how are you going to interact with the program manager as the technical lead? So good luck. It's been fun. And I'll see you probably in January. Thank you.